This is Car Expert.
This pricing is very ambitious. I don't think Peugeot expects to sell a lot of them, and kudos for bringing them in anyway.
I do think that if you are in the market for an expensive German coupe SUV, and you are going to start spending around that money, you might as well just do it properly and buy the SQ5.
It was the lowest October result since 2002, so 20 years.
Wow. Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. G'day, Scott Colley.
Hello, Mandy.
And hello, William Stopforward.
Hello, Mandy.
Will, I always really enjoy those feature stories that you do at the site. And this one is, you've written about the cars that nobody is buying.
Yes. Well, the best cars nobody's buying.
Oh, the best cars nobody's buying.
Just to be clear, I didn't include the crappy cars nobody's buying.
I was going to say also, nor the really expensive cars, because the Rolls-Royce Ghost, for example, it's easy to understand why very few people buy them.
It only accounts for 0.01% of its segment. What a failure. No. For this article, I decided to look at cars that have, you know, roughly around like 1% or less share of their segment, according to VFAX, excluding the low volume stuff and excluding the stuff that, you know, maybe there's a reason why it's not all that popular. There are some vehicles currently on the market that don't sell all that well because they're priced a lot higher than their rivals. So Honda Accord comes to mind. Or they're a few years old and, you know, we're waiting for an update or replacements. The Havel H9, there's an example. Or both in the case of the Toyota Prius. Then there are some niche performance vehicles like the Ford Fiesta ST and Renault Megane RS that they're low volume because it's a niche segment. So I decided to just look at vehicles, also excluding vehicles that have recently been introduced, because I don't want to say they're not selling yet if they haven't really had a chance to sell. And I put together a list of 10 vehicles. Now, I called the article "The Best Cars Nobody's Buying." Now, I just want to make really clear, I'm not saying that these are the best cars, like, oh my God, drop everything. These are the absolute most fabulous cars you can ever buy ever. But I'm talking about the best of Australia's most unpopular vehicles. And these cars are all genuinely pretty good. So we got a couple of Fords on there, a couple of SsangYongs, a couple of Peugeots, a Renault, a Skoda, and also, oh, sorry, I lie, 3 SsangYongs. I'm so sorry, SsangYong. Unfortunately, you're not doing better. But also a Hyundai as well. So there's a real.
Should we do the guessing game? Scully.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I have read the article, but it was a while ago. So no, that's okay. I have a memory like a sieve.
Let's play the memory game. All right.
The Hyundai. That one's got me. Would it be the i30N?
No.
Is it a sedan?
No. No.
Is it a fastbacky coupe thing?
It's a hatchback.
Oh, so it's a Sonata N-line then?
No, we just playing.
Oh, it's not.
No, Sonata's Sonata's a sedan, isn't it? I'm pretty sure that's a notchback sedan.
Oh, okay.
It's very sleek. They all kind of blur together now. I didn't include the Sonata just because the midsize segment is, you know, it's pretty much Toyota Camry and nothing else in terms of sales. So there's a lot of really good cars in there, but people aren't really buying midsizes. So I didn't want to clog it up with
Elantra?
No, Elantra's gone. Shall I put you guys out of your misery?
Of course it is. Yeah.
Hang on. Give me one more. Sorry. It's a hatchback.
It's a hatchback. Yes.
It's not the i30. The i20N's brand new, so we don't know who's buying that.
What are we missing?
Everyone is listening to this podcast right now, going, "Oh God, Scott, it's this."
They're probably yelling
this.
At us.
Yeah. Hello, Hyundai PR and marketing staff. to put us out of our misery. Sorry.
Ionic.
I had honestly forgotten it existed.
And so did everyone else, because Hyundai sold only 310 of them this year. So that's technically 0.4%.
It's a really good little car too.
Yeah, it is. And look, how many cars on the market offer the choice between a hybrid, a plug-in hybrid, and a full electric version?
And the Kia Sorento and that, I think, are it for the moment.
Yeah, well, there's also the Kia Niro, which I mentioned in the article. Even though it was only introduced during the year, it is already selling the Ioniq, which probably should tell you something about what kind of shape of car people are after. So SUV, cool. Hatchback, not so much. So I've got the Ioniq in there. There's a real kind of mixture of cars here. I am planning on actually, I need to finish it this afternoon, note to self, a part two of this article, which will be the best luxury cars nobody's buying. I'll be very, do you want to play the guessing game as to what's going to be in that article?
If it doesn't start with G and end with Enesis, I'd be very surprised knowing you.
No, knowing. Remember my rules there. If it's something that's only very recently been introduced, I'm probably not going to include it in the article.
Okay, so alphabetically, Audi A8.
Oh, nobody cares about that segment.
Just sort of playing backyard cricket with an older brother at Christmas. The rules keep changing. Can't go out first ball, can't go out third ball if a bird's flying across the pool.
Yeah,
can't go out fifth ball if there's snags on the barbecue and dad's clapping.
I can assure you I've never played backyard cricket with my brother. We're not backyard cricket players.
Yeah, I was also the older brother, so it was me making the rules, but still.
But definitely a couple of Alphas on the list.
Yeah.
A couple of Jaguars. So a bit of a shorter list for this part two, but that should be going live this weekend, so it should be live on the website by the time y'all hear this.
Cool. Hey, Scully, you've got, we just touched on it earlier, the Honda Accord in the garage at the moment.
I can't
think the last time I saw one of these on the road.
No, they're very, very rare, and I can understand why. I mean, it is in a segment that people are moving away from, and it's expensive relative to a Camry. It doesn't have the same weight, that name, that maybe it once did, but it's a really good looking car. Interesting looking sedan that doesn't go as far as the Sonata N line or the Camry and trying to look sporty. It's just a nice shape. And having driven one previously, it's really quiet and really comfortable. It's a beautiful car, but it just is, it's at a price point very few people are looking at and a segment very few people are buying, unfortunately. So yeah, I'm looking forward. Mike's reviewing that one, so I'm looking forward to hearing his thoughts on it, because it's one of those cars that, again, you sort of forget is around, but realistically is a great sedan that more people should consider.
It's just frustrating because you think, you know, Thai built, that it might be a little bit cheaper, it might have an advantage over its rivals, but it's just too pricey. And it's really unfortunate because it's genuinely a good car. And if I could go back to my old neighborhood in New York, it's infested with Accords and Camrys. Virtually every car on the street, unless it's an old minivan, is a new Accord or Camry. That's partly because they're popular with livery cab drivers. But fundamentally, the Accord is a huge seller in the US. From memory, it's also a huge seller in China, where, let's not forget, Honda is the number two brand. So every time people go, what's Honda doing? My answer is, well, they might not be doing so great here, but they're certainly doing great in the US and China. But that Accord, it's just got that price is just the biggest con against it.
Well, we're going to talk about some other overpriced cars coming up in car news, which is now. Now, Scully, the Toyota BZ4X has been detailed. What an odd model name.
How catchy is it? It sort of rolls off the tongue. RAV4, CHR, BZ4X.
It's in camel case as well. Lowercase b, uppercase z, lowercase x. It's the most annoying name to type.
So yeah, long.
It does look really strange. It's like, I can't explain why they've gone that way. There is some internal logic to it. I mean, the B is battery electric. The 4Z is, I don't know, something to do with Akio Toyota's star sign maybe. And then the X is because it's an SUV. I don't know. It has been. We make fun of it, but this is a massive deal, this car, because obviously Toyota is in Australia the biggest car maker selling cars by the length of the straight, and globally it's one of the big couple of car makers. And it's been quite late to the pure electric party compared to the likes of Volkswagen and of even Stellantis. The artist formerly known as FCA, PSA, and, all the other brands that made that up. It's been really big on hybrids, especially in Australia, and it's sort of waited for when it thinks people to be ready for electric cars and for the technology to be ready for it to just sell the electric car that people want, not one that people have to settle for. The BZ4X was first revealed in April, and it's built on a pure electric platform that's a variation of the TNGA architecture that Toyota uses under all its other cars. It's actually been developed alongside Subaru, and Subaru is going to do a version called the Solterra. It's sort of a Hyundai Ioniq 5, Kia EV6, Nissan Ariya rival. Mm. Longer and lower than a Toyota RAV4, but that same kind of mid-sized SUV. Where Toyota differs from a lot of its rivals is it's not doing a performance version. The base model is front-wheel drive and has a 150-kilowatt motor. The top model will have two 80-kilowatt motors for 160 kilowatts, all-wheel drive, and a 7.7-second sprint to 100 k's an hour. Obviously, that is going to disappoint people like Paul who really love their Tesla for the performance. But realistically, that's still faster than most hybrid or internal combustion normal cars actually, you know, do. It's got a 71.4 kilowatt hour lithium ion battery pack. And with the front wheel drive, you'd expect about 500 kilometers of range, 460 kilometers using the in the all wheel drive using the tougher European test cycle. And it'll fast charge at 150 kilowatts. All of this is in keeping with what we expect from its rivals. So Toyota isn't reinventing the wheel, but it's also not going to disappoint you compared to what you can get from the rivals we mentioned earlier. Toyota says it wants the battery to retain 90% of its capacity after 10 years or 240,000 kilometers of driving. That's actually better than the warranties that most brands offer. I don't know if that's what Toyota is going to offer as its warranty, but it's better than the guarantee that most brands offer, which will generally do 8 years, 200,000 kilometers for 80% battery capacity. Toyota also says it's developed a unique heat pump for the air conditioning and heating that's designed to be more efficient and get more life out of the battery. I think maybe the last really interesting thing about it is that it has a solar roof that Toyota says can add 1,800 kilometers of distance, which is exciting, per year, which is less exciting. Essentially, if you park the car in the sun, it can trickle charge with that solar roof option added. It's something that we saw first on the Fisker Karma, which was that interesting hybrid that then went under and then came back, but as a Chinese-owned brand, and now Henrik Fisker's doing his own thing. It's a cool idea I think we'll see more of. Hyundai offers it overseas, I believe, on the IONIQ 5 as well. But, yeah, whether it'll be standard or not in Australia, where it could actually be really useful given how hot and how much UV we get over here, whether it'll be standard, we don't know.
It's going to be really interesting to see what the supply is going to be like once it gets here, because we've seen how quickly the Hyundai IONIQ 5 orders were all gobbled up. And I know the RAV4 hybrid is a hybrid compared to what this one is, but we've seen, you know, up to 12 months wait. So it's going to be interesting to see what Toyota Australia, how many numbers they're going to bring here.
So what Toyota has said is that they don't expect any supply shortages. They actually announced this information at a press conference about their supply shortages. So realistically, it would make sense they check this information before firing, and Toyota doesn't sort of shoot from the hip. They're very well prepared generally. Obviously, there's a lot that can change. This car's not meant to be here until late in 2022. And between now and then, I think if 2020 and 2021 have taught us anything, we just don't know what's going to happen. So it's not, you know, unthinkable that between now and then something will happen globally that will affect the supply. But for now, Toyota is expecting to have enough supply of the car.
And they're also managing expectations as well by saying it will be expensive. So we don't know how much it's going to cost locally, but they've already just put it out there and said, hey, just like the first generation Prius, this is going to be expensive. So I'm very curious, because I think Toyota's come right at an inflection point for electric vehicles. And a lot of people will just look at the BZ4X and go, well, I can get more performance with a Tesla Model Y. But there's also a lot of people who are very, 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 very loyal Toyota buyers who might not have considered an electric vehicle before. And Toyota generally doesn't bring things out half-baked or shoddily made. That's not to say that a Tesla is. But this is going to appeal to Toyota buyers and electric car buyers alike.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the hurdles to getting people into electric cars is them working out which electric car to buy, which brands to trust, what the difference is with the technology. I don't think it's ridiculous to assume that in 12 months or 24 months' time, there's going to be a whole lot of people trading in their RAV4 hybrids who are thinking about going electric. And the fact they can go back to the same dealer and say, I'm thinking of going electric, and the dealer can say, how about this BZ4X, which is, I assume, how they'll pronounce it based on how it's written. It's the same size as your RAV4. It's going to cost you the same to look after every year. We can roll over your lease on it. It's a bit more expensive. And they're just going to go, brilliant. Because, you know, as we know already, a lot of people are thinking of going electric. The charging situation is getting better in Australia, and people are starting to wrap their head around how that works. It's just another hurdle that's being removed, the fact that Australia's biggest car maker all of a sudden has an option.
I think the most curious thing about the BZ4X, and I know it likely won't come here, but it's that yoke steering wheel, because that is a I can't even say steering wheel, can I? It's just a yoke. It is such a weird thing for Toyota to do. I don't know. I know they've been a little bit more adventurous lately, but that's just completely out of left field for Toyota. I hate the idea. You guys may differ.
No, I agree. I'm very anti as well. I think it's a Chinese market thing. And we know in China, the buyers have different preferences. Car makers are trying different things. Wouldn't surprise me if this is just Toyota going, hey, guys, we're cool.
Hello, fellow children.
Yeah, how do you do?
Oh, God. Now, on to another Japanese make. Now, we'll Mitsubishi Outlander PHEV. We have all the details for this one.
Yeah, so we're going from talking about an electric SUV to a plug-in hybrid SUV. Mitsubishi's new Outlander, of course, is going to have a plug-in hybrid version, as the previous one did. And, of course, Mitsubishi was one of the early adopters of plug-in hybrid technology. And for a while, it's like they pretty much had that part of the market to themselves. That's not to say it's an especially popular part of the market, because as we've seen, and as Mitsubishi has conceded recently in Australia, people don't seem to know what the hell a plug-in hybrid is. Mm. But this is a very good thing, because not only is it based on the redesigned Outlander, which is just a much, much more impressive looking vehicle inside and out, but it has a lot more range. So Mitsubishi says the new Outlander FEV, which also will be available with a third row of seating for the first time, will have a claimed 83 to 87 kilometers of pure electric range on the WLTP test cycle. Now, the current, well, the outgoing vehicle has only 54 kilometers, and that's on the more lenient NEDC cycle. So that's actually a really significant jump in electric-only range. And if you think about how much you're actually driving each day, like to and from work, it, you know, in theory means you might not really ever use the petrol motor unless you're going away for the weekend. So the old 13.8 kilowatt-hour battery has been swapped out for a larger 20 kilowatt-hour battery. Mitsubishi says it's increased the power of its electric motors by around 40%. So it still uses a 2.4-litre four-cylinder Myvec engine. So unlike the rest of the Outlander range, which, correct me if I'm wrong, is actually switched to a Nissan engine. The engine itself has got 98 kilowatts of power and 195 newton meters of torque. It's mated with two electric motors, one with 85 kilowatts and 255 newton meters. The other with 100 kilowatts and 195. There's no combined system output figure available, which, you know, it's a bit annoying, but anyway. So it does have all-wheel drive. And Mitsubishi says, hey, look, we've even increased the driving range for the petrol engine by putting a bigger fuel tank there. So there's a new booster function for the front electric motor, which Mitsubishi says will raise the supply of energy to the front motor while reducing power consumption. And there are also seven drive modes to choose from, normal, tarmac, gravel. Seven. I know. It's going to be one big dial.
Yeah. No.
Normal, tarmac, gravel, snow, mud, power, and eco.
Sorry, I didn't get the fourth one.
Too late. We're moving on. the Mitsubishi's Super All-Wheel Control, that's such a retro Japanese kind of system name, isn't it? It gets a new active yaw control function for the rear wheels. As I mentioned before as well, it actually has a third row of seats for the first time. So the previous generation of Outlander, you could get a third row, but you couldn't get it with a FEV because of the way the battery was packaged. Mm. So now you've got that option. And there's already not that many plug-in hybrid SUVs out there. I know there are a few more coming to the market with the new Peugeot 3008. We'll come back to that. To have a three-row plug-in hybrid SUV, especially in Australia where plug-in hybrids are far, far, far less prevalent than they are in Europe, it's interesting.
The interesting thing with this Outlander, I think, is going to be whether it can deliver mainstream appeal. The FEV that is here now is a really interesting car, and it was a real pioneer when it launched. But it's never been a big seller for Mitsubishi. It's more of a car that people buy and love and, you know, tell their friends about. It's more of a cult kind of car, or a car for people who are really interested in the technology and wanted to be ahead of the electric curve. It's also worth remembering that Mitsubishi was ahead of the electric curve with the iMiEV, which was also a Peugeot and now looks like a science experiment compared to electric cars. But Mitsubishi was really up to date with that stuff. The new one we know looks better. It's going to be bigger inside, have more technology. It's going to be more expensive, although how much more expensive remains to be seen. presumably not Peugeot 3008 expensive, which we will get to. But yeah, it'll be really interesting to see if Mitsubishi is able to make this the car that cracks into people's psyche what a FEV is and what it can do for them. Because we know they're not for everyone, and we've talked about that on the podcast before, but for the right person, there are real benefits to going to a plug-in hybrid versus a normal Toyota-style hybrid or a full electric car.
That's the thing. Toyota's been able to just grow the percentage of hybrid sales for each of its models by so much because the price premium between a regular petrol Toyota and a hybrid Toyota is really quite small nowadays when you think about it. And as a bonus, you're getting extra performance. But with plug-in hybrids, what we've seen is often the premium is like 10 to 15, sometimes 20 grand. And you can talk until you're blue in the face about the advantages of plug-in hybrids. And as we've said on the podcast before, they really do work for a lot of people. The number of people I've spoken to who have been like, oh, I'm not ready to go electric because I might drive, you know, all the way to Rockhampton. Plug-in hybrids make a lot of sense for these people that might be considering these long-distance trips. But do they make enough sense for people to plonk down an extra 10 to 15 grand?
Mm.
That's the problem Mitsubishi has here. So let's see. Well, they could surprise us with pricing, but we won't know until closer to launch.
Well, while we're on the topic, as you guys just mentioned before, Peugeot will, as you've said in your notes here, has overpriced its EVs.
Yeah, they have. Because Peugeot's 3008 and 508 plug-in hybrids are finally coming in early 2022, and they just revealed the pricing yesterday. Sorry, I'm trying not to laugh.
Come on, be nice.
it's so unfortunate because Peugeot makes really nice cars.
I know.
They're genuinely nice. They look fantastic inside and out. Mm-hmm. But this pricing... So the 508 GT Fastback plug-in hybrid, catchy name, is priced at $76,990 before on-road costs, which is, I want to say roughly $20,000 more than just the regular petrol model.
Holy wow.
So we're talking about how plug-in hybrids often have like a, you know, a premium of like 10 to 15 grand.
Yeah,
around 20 grand this time. You can't get it in the wagon. It's only in the fastback. And then you've got the 3008 GT Sport plug-in hybrid, which rings up at $79,990 before on-road costs. Now, for reference, this is... And we're talking about a bigger car here, a segment up with a third row of seating. The Kia Sorento plug-in hybrid, which I think some of us had a bit of a surprise kind of chuckle about when pricing was revealed for that. That's priced at $81,990 drive away. So it really gives you an idea there where Peugeot has got this very premium approach to its pricing, but doesn't necessarily have the cachet to kind of back that up. And just for more reference, that 508... if you were to look at, there's not really that much competition in terms of plug-in hybrid passenger cars in Australia. A lot of brands just don't bring them over here because there's just too much demand in Europe, or there's just too little demand here, a combination of both. But a BMW 330e plug-in hybrid is around 83-84 grand before on-road costs. So we're talking about just not that much more to step up from a Peugeot to a BMW.
I do think that we need to acknowledge the fact Peugeot does build beautiful cars, like you said, Will, but also that it's a small brand in Australia trying to bring in a new technology. And the price difference between the 3008 FEV and 3008 petrol GT Sport isn't all that much bigger than we have seen from other brands with their plug-in hybrids. The Kia Sorento is similar. The Mercedes GLC is a little bit different, but you can still pay a lot more for a FEV than you do the entry-level model. And we're expecting to see it with the Mitsubishi Outland, although the gap won't be quite as big as our understanding. So Peugeot isn't doing something particularly egregious that no other brand is doing. It's more just that because it is so small and because it is a premium-ish brand that wants to be premium, the starting point is quite high. And then they've just added the full whack on top rather than taking a hit and trying to introduce the technology. So to put into context what Peugeot is doing, it's not all that far from what other brands are doing, but it just, because it's starting where it's starting and because the car is what it is, it feels more expensive again.
And that you're absolutely right there. The premium compared to the regular petrol models is not out of the ordinary. However, The difference with Peugeot's regular petrol models is they are on the pricier end of the spectrum if you think of Peugeot as a mainstream brand. And I'm not talking mainstream in terms of volume. I'm talking mainstream in terms of positioning and price. But if we look at just the regular 3008 range, a base model 3008 is priced roughly at the high end of a rival's kind of X-Trail, Outlander, RAV4 kind of range. So already they're coming with a premium. And then you add the plug-in hybrid premium, which is maybe a little bit larger than the plug-in hybrid premium we usually see at this end of the market. And then that's how we get to more than 80 grand drive away for a Peugeot. Now, if we're talking specs here, the 508 GT Fastback Plug-in Hybrid, I'm just going to say the 508 from now on, it mates a turbocharged 1.6-litre four-cylinder engine with a 11.8-kilowatt-hour battery. So you've got a total system output of 165 kilowatts, which is actually the same power output as the regular 508 GT. So there's not like there's no torque figure. There's no combined torque figure. So I will say that. You do have a pure electric driving range of 55 kilometers. And Peugeot says it can travel it up to 135 kilometers an hour without switching on the petrol engine. Peugeot hasn't revealed full specifications for either of these models yet, but it looks like it's the same. The features that they have mentioned are the same as what's already in the top models in these respective ranges. I think the 3008 is a little bit more interesting because it has all-wheel drive. It's got electric motors on each axle. So the front motor has got 81 kilowatts. The rear one's got 83 kilowatts. So combined, you're looking at 222 kilowatts of power, total system output, which is pretty sprightly for a midsize SUV. It's this segment is often the real doldrums of performance. Now, this also makes it the only all-wheel drive 3008 that you can buy in Australia. And 13.2 kilowatt hour battery and 59 kilometers of electric range, also on the tougher WLTP test cycle. Now, look, as I said before, these are lovely Peugeots. The 508 is stunning. I think the most beautiful midsize, or even if you lump in luxury brands in there. But this pricing is very ambitious. I don't think Peugeot expects to sell a lot of them. And kudos for bringing them in anyway, as you know, kind of, I guess, hero cars for the range. But this pricing is very, very, very ambitious. And what I find really interesting is Peugeot has this kind of, their interiors have come so far and they're just genuinely nice places to sit, where sometimes when you're getting in a top spec 3008, you're like, oh, this is pretty Audi grade, really. Sometimes nicer than an Audi interior. But Stellantis doesn't actually consider Peugeot as part of its premium suite of brands, because it considers Alfa Romeo, DS and Lancia. So Peugeot is more one of its more mainstream brands, and yet here it's positioned as a premium brand. And I don't know if people necessarily consider it as a premium brand. As much as we want to talk about how lovely the 3008 is, it was already ambitiously priced, and this is very ambitiously priced.
I think that's the problem. If you're talking about Peugeot, you look and you go, well, it's got a beautiful interior, and it's 10 grand less than a BMW X3, and it's 20 grand less than a Merc GLC. It's priced like a RAV4, but it's a French luxury car. That makes a heap of sense, and I think that's the way that people are going to get interested in that brand, as opposed to, it's beautiful, but it's front-wheel drive only. It's got a 1.6-litre engine. It's from a brand I haven't heard of in years, and it costs almost the same as a German luxury car. I can see what Peugeot's going for, but its pricing just doesn't quite bear it out, unfortunately.
Now, we have spoken about this in the past few Car Expert podcasts, but now it's finally been revealed, Scully, the Mercedes AMG SL. What do you reckon of this one?
I think this one looks hot. I know Will doesn't agree with me, and he will have his chance to be wrong, but I personally think it looks absolutely fantastic. This is the first SL that has been developed by AMG as opposed to Mercedes. Even though AMG is technically a part of Mercedes and that business, it's a separate sort of division, and they still have a presence in Offenbach as opposed to Mercedes head office in Stuttgart. So there is a bit of a difference there. And we know that the bones of this car will eventually underpin the AMG GT as well. Interestingly, as the rest of its AMG range starts to look to hybrids and plug-ins and four cylinders, Merc has just gone, there are two V8s for the SL. They're both all-wheel drive, and none of them are hybrid at launch. There will be one eventually, but to start with, it's just a 4-litre twin-turbo V8 with AMG performance all-wheel drive. So in the entry-level car, the base model, the poverty pack one, 350 kilowatts and 700 newton meters. Zero to 100 takes 3.9 seconds, and flat out you'll be doing 295 kilometers an hour. I mean, heaven forbid you have to settle for that. But if you can jump to the SL63, you're looking at 430 kilowatts, 800 newton meters, and a zero to 100 kilometer an hour time of 3.6 seconds. Flat out, you're doing 315 kilometers an hour. I think once you get beyond about 250 k's an hour, it all becomes a little bit irrelevant, but that difference will mean something. I don't know, if you're in the left lane of the autobahn in an SL55 flat out and someone comes up behind you and starts flashing the lights, you'll feel inferior.
Or the country club parking lot.
Yeah, which is probably a more accurate place these cars will spend their time. Interestingly, with this SL, and we have covered this previously, but it's gone from a folding hardtop back to a folding softtop, which is one of the reasons Mercedes has been able to make it look so good, because the bulky hardtop is really hard to stow. They've got awkward proportions when they're up. Whereas this soft top, it looks like a classic convertible with the roof up. And with it down, you've got quite a low, clean deck lid, which is quite hard to do with a convertible. The rest of the car is kind of standard Mercedes-Benz stuff. You've got a massive screen in the interior that tilts towards or away from the driver. The dash tunnel sort of aggressively is raked up like an AMG GT, the current model. I think it looks really cool. Although I would also have loved to see Mercedes do something like BMW did with the Z8 and do a beautiful retro interior for the SL and acknowledge that car's heritage, but this is the world we live in and that's not a realistic thing to expect. And it's got a full suite of active driver assists and technology things that I would probably bore you if I went through. It looks great. I know that we're going to throw it a wheel and he's going to say it doesn't look great.
I don't not like it. Why do you think I don't like it?
Will, why do you hate it?
It looks good in photos, and I know it's going to be one of those cars that really pops in person. But when I looked at it after this endless teaser campaign, I looked and I'm like, oh, I thought I was going to like this a little bit more. I don't know. For me, the high watermark of Mercedes SL styling is the R129. Of the 90s. That is my favorite. I don't even care about the gull wing. That is my dream SL. I love it. And I think subsequent SLs, the one that came after that with the R230, I like the look of that. And then the R231 that's just been phased out. I think at that point, Mercedes has this, I don't want to say same sausage, different lengths philosophy, but in terms of design, That's an expression. But Scott's making a face at me. But to me, it's the flagship model. I feel like it shouldn't slavishly adhere to whatever design elements proliferate throughout the rest of the range. And that was my problem with the outgoing SL, is it kind of just looked a little bit too Mercedes-y and not SL-y enough, if that makes sense. And so this current one, my initial reaction is, oh, it doesn't look kind of special enough. But then I look at the photos of it, I look at the rear, and I'm just like, that's going to pop in person. So I'm reserving judgment.
I think also the car pictured on Car Expert, the SL63 in red with the AMG wheels, is a really beautiful shape that is also covered with familiar AMG bits. And I think maybe that's part of the reason it doesn't look as SL as maybe you expected, because it is like, it's a beautiful car. It's a convertible with lovely proportions. But the wheels are AMG, the grille is very traditional AMG, all the trim bits are very traditional AMG, and they kind of take away from the fact that it is a unique SL. I wonder if the 55 on the chrome wheels that we see also in the story, and then the less powerful versions that we can only assume are coming, will actually look more like an SL because they're less AMG and they haven't got all those. It's cruel to call them parts bin because that's not what they are, but those familiar styling elements that we expect of an AMG GT or a C63 or exactly accoutrement or something like that.
Yeah. Okay, and our last story, Scully, South Australia passes its EV incentives and road user tax bill.
Yes. So South Australia has decided that, like New South Wales and Victoria, it's going to give electric car drivers some rebates when they buy their car. It's about a $22.7 million project, and it'll fund $3,000 subsidies to the first 7,000 fully electric vehicle buyers who make a claim. That's actually 1,000 cars more than the initial proposal. So South Australia's found it in its heart to offer some more electric car buyers some more money, which is good because we know that these things are important and do make a difference when people consider the price of an electric car and adoption. There is a price cap for the rebates, so you're not able just to buy a Mercedes EQC with all the options and claim $3,000 back. It's cars priced below $68,750. The other side of the South Australian thing that is a little bit more controversial is that it's passed an electric car road user charge, which is the same thing that Victoria has done, but unlike Victoria, which has rushed it out as quickly as it possibly can, South Australia won't start its charge until July 1, 2027, or when electric vehicle sales are 30% of all vehicle sales, which on this current rate is likely a long way off. So the charge will be the same as what Victoria is doing, 2.5 cents per kilometre for electric cars and 2 cents per kilometre for plug-in hybrids. But again, unlike Victoria, it's going to wait until electric vehicles have reached a much bigger percentage of the market. And the logic of that is that at that point, there's quite a lot of people not paying fuel excise, which obviously some of which as a federal tax goes toward funding road infrastructure, although it's not all put towards funding road infrastructure. That's another issue entirely. And if we ever start the Car Expert Politics Hour, we can get into it. But it's essentially a state taking control of a new revenue stream and promising that that money will be put in some form into electric car infrastructure and road maintenance, in a way that maybe what they're taking from petrol cars or what they can't take from petrol cars isn't. The Treasurer of South Australia, Rob Lucas, said this is a critical moment for the future of South Australia, and said the pace of change is overwhelming, where the future is zero emissions, the future is electric vehicles. So that's a very clear acknowledgement from the government that they believe that everything is going electric. I think also the fact that they've held this off until 2027 or until they reach a certain market percentage shows the government is trying to seed the technology and really push it before it starts to tax it, which is something that other states have done and Victoria has not done by offering rebates but also then charging Australia's only road user tax.
If you'd like to know more, head to carexpert.com.au and click the news link. G'day, Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy. How are you?
Very good. Well, I know you're very busy because you've just finished filing October's new car sales figures, as we call VFACTS. How did we go last month?
Not so well. The enduring global supply chain woes that we keep hearing about related to semiconductors and COVID shutdowns and the like are really starting to bite now. So simultaneously, the dealer networks are reporting pretty much record demand across the board, but an utter inability to deliver on said demand with actual vehicles in the hands of customers. So it was the lowest October result since 2002, so 20 years.
Wow.
When Will was 2 years old. And
thank you.
At 74,650 sales, that's not crash hot. Now, the market is on track to just sneak over the magic million mark, but it does have all the appearances of sort of crawling over the finish line. As you know, I drove over the Westgate Bridge in Melbourne on the way home from the office, and I drive past all of the major holding yards, AutoNexus and Patrick's and things, and they are empty at the moment. So these figures shouldn't surprise all that much. Just to give you a quick breakdown of the top brands, we had Toyota in number one position, despite being down more than 20%. Hyundai second, Ford third, with three quarters of its sales coming just from the Ranger. Mazda in fourth, down 30%. Kia in fifth. Mitsubishi, Nissan in sixth and seventh. Then MG up nearly 90%, now in eighth position. So that company's irrevocable march up the charts continues unabated. Volkswagen ninth and Subaru 10th, meaning Mercedes-Benz and Isuzu just on the outer. The biggest grower, though, was GWM, which is Great Wall Motor, inclusive of Haval, yet another fast-growing cheap Chinese manufacturer, up 300% and in 14th place for the month. So we're looking at having, well, now we officially have four Chinese manufacturers or three manufacturers and four brands from China in the top 15 companies. So
wow.
Definitely a trend there.
How did we go with the top models?
Yeah, so the top models, not a huge amount of surprises. Ranger first, quite comfortably for the month, actually, for the second month in a row. Hasn't quite overtaken Hilux year to date yet, but it's going to be a very close run race. There is a very real opportunity that a Ford product might be the number one vehicle in the country by the end of the year. It's going to be very, very neck and neck. So yeah, Ranger, Hilux 1-2. D-Max came fifth from Isuzu. So three of the top five were dual cab utes, with the Corolla and the Hyundai i30 falling into the top 5 as well. Rounding out the top 10, RAV4 and Tucson in 6th and 7th ahead of Mitsubishi ASX. I would suggest a big beneficiary of the rental car boom that we're seeing at the moment. Nissan X-Trail, it might be as old as the hills, but there's obviously plenty of them because that was 9th and Kia Cerato in 10th. So I'm doing well. One that sort of surprised me was Toyota Land Cruiser. So 1,348 70 Series sales and about 600-odd Land Cruiser wagon sales. So I called Toyota and I called the FCAI, and the FCAI assured me that, no, sales are registrations. It means that to count as a sale, you have to have got the keys in your hands. And yet Toyota keeps saying, we've got no Land Cruisers, we've got none, just place your order and you might get one sometime down the line. What it seems to be is that there were the Demonstrator 300s that counted. There's a handful of old 200s left. And then there's obviously a ton of 70 Series that have been floating around at the back of dealers without plates on them for a while. Because I imagine, and this is just me speculating, I'm not alleging anything, but I imagine you're probably getting a pretty good price for them at the moment, so it would be advantageous to sell them at the moment. So, yeah, not a particularly unusual breakdown of vehicles, but definitely lower numbers than we're used to seeing. Scully.
I was actually going to ask you about Land Cruiser, but you've already answered that pretty well. I am curious about Patrol because that was selling really strongly, and now we know there's a new Land Cruiser. All of a sudden, that car may not be as appealing to people. And sort of further to that, what about the ute-based SUVs that people seem to love taking off-road and touring at the moment?
So, yeah, Nissan Patrol, 309 sales for the month. It's funny you ask that. I was speaking to Nissan yesterday about it, and they acknowledge that, like a lot of brands, they're just stuffed as far as supply goes. They've got a huge backlog of orders. The next shipment of Patrols is already spoken for. So it's simply a case of not being able to satisfy demand for that car, not even close to it, and Nissan will be tearing its hair out as a result. In terms of the off-road 4x4s, yeah, look, we didn't have a huge month, really. Prado far and away number one with 1,051. And then none of them did huge numbers. We had the Isuzu MU-X with 671, obviously, again, supply constrained, sounded like a broken record then. Still, it did beat the Everest on 543 sales and the Mitsubishi Pajero Sport with 606. So that was sitting between those two aforementioned cars. Not the best month for those towing vehicles, which, again, is very much a supply rather than a demand side thing.
No doubt SUVs would have walked all over the top segment for the month.
Yeah, so 47% of all cars sold were classified as an SUV, although that's an increasingly nebulous term, as we know. 4x4 utes was the biggest single segment, but medium, large and small SUVs combined had about 41% of the total market. So that really is the sweet spot these days, absolutely. And you know, again, a significant number of those top 20 models, the SUVs.
How did the states and territories compare?
Yeah, so it was a pretty grim summary, really, for most of the states. All bar one went down. So Victoria actually grew 6.3%, but that's more reflective of the fact that October 2020 was an absolute shocker for Victoria because we down here had a few more restrictions in lots of other places last year. But all the other states were down and territories were down as well by up to 22%, and in the case of a few other ones, around the 10% mark. So pretty much unanimous steady decline across the nation. SsangYong was a bit of a surprise. That was up nearly 100% and did really, really well, which shows that there's still an appetite for cheap cars. EVs are always worth talking about. So 461 electric cars sold, excluding Tesla, which, as you know, we like to say here, it refuses to provide us with sales data. So up 150%, which is, you know, on track with how EVs have been tracking all year. So we're seeing really consistent growth now. And the thing about that is growth off a small base means that your volume's not going to be very high, but we are starting to see those EV volumes, especially with various states and territories getting on board with subsidies and rebates. We're starting to see that take up, you know, escalate. And I see no reason why in 22 that won't sort of continue.
Yeah, absolutely. The full report is live at carexpert.com.au. Thank you, Mike Costello.
Thank you, guys.
All right, well, the next review is going to be a mixture of two cars that are sort of the same but a little bit different, the Audi Q5 and the Audi SQ5. And we've got James Wong to join us as well. Hello, J-Wo.
Hello, hello.
Could you just tell us the difference between the Q5 and the SQ5?
Well, the Q5 and the SQ5, the main difference is what powers them. I guess what makes the two cars that we're talking about today a bit more special is that they're the new Sportback versions. So for the longest time, Audi hasn't really been up against the likes of the BMW X4 and the Mercedes-Benz GLC Coupe with the we'll say SUV coupe. That's normally the accepted term. So earlier this year they revealed it, or late last year they revealed it for Europe, and then
I think time is just a flat circle at this point. Doesn't
I can't remember. Really, I don't know what planet, universe, date, year I'm in at the moment. So at some point in the recent past, but not so recent that it was this year, I don't know. It was revealed at a point in time and it is now here. Long story short. So Scott and I have been driving two different variants. So I drove the SQ5 TDI Sportback and Scott's driven the 45 TFSI Quattro Sportback. They're pretty long-winded names. It was actually my first time driving an SQ5 of any sort. There's been two generations and three different engines and now two body styles. It's a bit confusing, but basically the launch program is a little bit different to what we're used to. Basically, Audi allocates us a day where we pick it up from a set location, drive it around for the day and then return it. So we've both now done that and it was a lot of fun.
So your first experience with an SQ5, was it a good one?
Yeah. I've sort of started off my written review sort of talking about how the SQ5 as a nameplate has sort of got like a cult following. I feel like everyone loves them, or they, you know, someone knows someone who's had one, and, you know, they're well known for being a really great all-rounder. And because I'd never actually experienced one for myself, I've never been able to substantiate that claim. It was a really good way to sort of sink my teeth into it. I think the new one it looks great, even as a Sportback. I wasn't sold on the looks when it first was revealed. And you hop in and you press the starter button and it doesn't actually sound like a diesel because they've got these sound actuators in the exhaust area so that it sounds like a V8 almost. And then inside it pumps a fake sound in as well. It's not super believable, I guess, because for people like us who know these things, you sort of go like, oh yeah, there's the fake sound playing again. But I guess to some people it's quite believable, and it's just got this really effortless and muscular nature to it. In the review, I sort of say, you know, this is not, even though, you know, Audi brands its S cars with S, which might be sport and you might associate with a sports car and maybe more engaging or sharp handling or whatever, I think that the S range, and particularly something like an SQ5, is more of a, you know, a long range GT rather than, you know, a corner carving sports car. It's very at home. It's at home on, like, you know, long sweeping bends and country highways where it can just eat up the miles. You sink your boot in and it'll do an overtake before you even realize, and you'll be well over the speed limit. And it's just a really comfortable, refined all rounder with plenty of grunt. And it's not pretending to be something it's not. And I think that's something that I really appreciated about it. It's not one of those performance SUVs that tries too hard to be, you know, a Porsche Boxster or a Mazda MX-5. It doesn't pretend to be this tiny little thing that can spin on a dime and cock one of its wheels up as it goes around a bend. It's very, like, you know, it's a big comfy thing that will just shoot towards the horizon when you feel like it. And then when you want to pack your kids and your dog and whoever else you want to take around with you, it can do that. And then also being the diesel in the case of the SQ5, it's actually surprisingly efficient as well.
A lot of people don't think of diesel as the right fuel for a performance car or an interesting car, and Audi sort of messed around with it, going from diesel to petrol and now back to diesel. Do you like the engine in this SQ5, and do you think it suits the character of the car?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm one, maybe one of the few people these days, I don't know, but I'm a firm believer that there's still a place for diesel in the modern automotive landscape. And I think there is a place for diesel in modern performance cars, depending on what kind of car it is. I think in a car like this, it's perfect. It's an SUV, you know, it's meant to be carrying people around and luggage and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, you think of the average buyer, it's normally a parent or something like that. You've got kids. You don't want to be at the pump all the time. So if you're very I'm very pragmatic in terms of my car purchases. Like, I own a Golf GTI, for example. Economy was actually a consideration of mine because I didn't want to be spending too much on fuel. And I imagine that, like, this is almost like a big diesel version of that. It's very, it's a good all rounder. The diesel's very effortless and refined. You wouldn't know it's a diesel half the time, and it's got more than enough performance. Like a 0 to 100 time of 5.1 seconds is nothing to sneeze at. And you know, Audi's done a lot of work to try and clean out the exhaust systems in these things. So all of the latest Q5 diesel models across both the SUV and Sportback ranges have new twin dosing technology. So it injects AdBlue in two different areas of the exhaust, and the nitrous oxide levels are about more than 90% reduced compared to previous generations of diesels to meet, it's like the latest Euro 6D emission standards or something. So basically the powertrain we get here is in line with what's in Europe, and the amount of emissions that it puts out is almost on par with petrol. So anyone who might think, oh, you know, diesel's dirty and all this other stuff, I think that provided they're not lying about what's actually coming out of the tailpipes. Mind you, the tailpipes on the back are also fake. They're under the bumper, which is another thing that I received a lot of messages about after I put some photos up on Instagram. But I think it definitely suits the character. I actually really enjoyed my time with the Alpina XD3 a few years ago, which is sort of like a similar car. The SQ5 and the XD3 are very similar in that they're both performance SUVs with high-powered diesel engines. And I think in these kind of cars, for the intended buyer and also the intended use, like you're not going to be going to a racetrack in any of these things. I don't imagine someone with a GLC 43 or an X4 M40i going to be going to Sandown anytime soon and setting a lap record. So I think for that reason, you know, a car like this is with a high-powered diesel, like the effortless acceleration, the great fuel economy, it all just works. And the way the 8-speed automatic is a great partner for this engine. It shifts really quickly. It's, you know, it doesn't suffer from any of that low-speed hesitation that we found in some dual-clutch alternatives. You know, when you press one of the paddles, it actually shifts, which, you know, it's not all manufacturers get right. I just love everything about it. And while it isn't the case here, the same engine is in the S6, the S7, and I think even the S8 in Europe. They've been doing TDI versions of some of the S models that we don't get here. And, you know, it offers equivalent performance to the equivalent V6 petrol while also slashing fuel economy and emissions. So what's not to love?
So, guys, between the two models that you drove, which one do you think is better value for money?
So the model that I've been driving is the 45 TFSI, and I say been driving, I've literally walked out of that car into the office and then sat down at the microphone right now, so it's very fresh. if I'm stuttering my words, that's why. It's priced at $86,300 before on-road costs, and then the car that we had a whole lot of options on it, including ambient lighting, piano black interior trim, which you should never, ever tick, quantum grey paint, black exterior styling, and then the Technic package, which is a $5,000 option that gives you matrix LED headlights, OLED tail lights, a Bang & Olufsen 3D sound system, which is just awesome. It absolutely cranks. Privacy glass and a head-up display. I would be happy with none of those options ticked, and I think at $86,300, it represents really good value, not just relative to the SQ5, but also relative to the BMW X4 30i and the Mercedes GLC Coupe. Once you start ticking options, it is possible to make your Q5 Sportback cost about 100 grand before on-roads. And at that point, it's only 10 grand less expensive than the SQ5. I know that's a lot of money. And I know 10 grand is not just throwaway cash for anyone. But I do think that if you are in the market for an expensive German coupe SUV and you are going to start spending around that money, you might as well just do it properly and buy the SQ5 if you can afford to do it. Because the SQ5, I mean, like James said, that engine is just awesome. It's one of my favorite SUVs to drive because it just feels like it would pull you from Melbourne to Sydney without even, you know, breaking a sweat, and then drive you home again, and you'd be comfortable and relaxed and have used no fuel on the way. It's a brilliant, brilliant car. So it really depends on how you option the car, in my opinion. I think the 45 is good value with nothing on there, but if you really want to go into the options, you're just better off going all out and buying the SQ5.
So I take it the SQ5 petrol is just a distant memory for you, Scott. Did you get a chance to drive that when it was still around?
I did, and I liked it. It was nice, but I think that the SQ5 has always been about the diesel. I've driven a first-generation car. A family friend of mine has one and just adores it and refused to sell it when the new SQ5 came out because he didn't want the petrol. I've heard a few stories like that. And even Audi, when they launched this TDI, earlier this year or late last year, again, the time circle that we're talking about before, was saying that it's expecting sales of the SQ5 to jump and the percentage of sales within the Audi Q5 range that it represents to jump as well. So I don't think I'm alone in that. There are people out there who've had the first gen diesel who've really wanted the second gen car to have that, and they're finally getting that option.
Because I drove the current Q5 and I was surprised how much I enjoyed it. And then I got into an SQ5 petrol and I'm like, oh, this is going to be great. So now I'm really, really keen to drive the SQ5 diesel based on this feedback.
I think also what's important to talk about as well is the packaging, because a lot of SUV coupes obviously have severely compromised packaging in terms of like rear headroom or whether it's luggage space or whatever. So what Audi's done here is that even though the tailgate's tapered off and you've got a different silhouette at the rear, the headroom is only impacted minimally even with the panoramic sunroof. So I found that I could actually sit behind my own driving position with plenty of room to spare. And the boot space is actually only reduced by 10 litres in five-seat form compared to the Q5 SUV. So you're not making that much of a compromise. And in terms of pricing, there's only about a $5,000 difference there between, I know for the SQ5, it's only about $5,000. I think the lower models, it might be a little bit more because the 40 TDI and the 45 TFSI pick up a bit more equipment than the equivalent Q5 SUV. So it's, what Audi's doing really well at the moment is they're making really good value cars. I remember maybe 5 or 10 years ago there was this running joke that everything in an Audi was optional bar the steering wheel, similar to what we say about JLR products. But what for some reason they've managed to do really, really well specified cars at competitive pricing. I was running the numbers, and I'm sure Scott's about to tell us a similar story. But compared to say an X4 M40i or a GLC 43, the SQ5 Sportback is about $15,000 to $20,000 cheaper, which for the same level of performance, I'm pretty sure it's better spec'd as well, because most of those two cars still require a handful of options to really deck them out. There's no options on the SQ5 other than a couple of personalization options. It's pretty much got all the equipment you want as standard. So they've done a really good job for, I think it's like $110,000 plus on roads. The car I had the OLED tail lights and something else for a couple of grand extra. And, the only thing I would perhaps change about the car I had is put air suspension on it, which is a couple of grand. I think that that would probably suit the character of that car even better. And when you have 21-inch wheels with basically bicycle tires protecting the rim from the road, I think it's you're better off having better off, again, for the intended purpose. If you're driving over tram tracks and stuff, like the adaptive normal suspension is fine, but I think the air suspension, I just love air suspension in cars like this. And I know that Audi products on this platform with air suspension are just like magic carpet smooth. So I imagine that the SQ5 would be no different.
Yeah, I think like JWo was saying, this is much cheaper than the equivalent BMW or Merc. Based on list price, this Q5 45 is in line with the base X4, which has less power and way less equipment. Even without ticking options boxes, the one that I drove has Nappa leather, a panoramic sunroof, among other really like high-end feeling things. It represents really good value, and it's great to see that Audi has realized that maybe that's what it has to do to cut through in some of the segments it hasn't been able to. So, yeah, I agree with James on that one. What I am curious about, though, is whether, based on the pictures and James, based on seeing the car in person, you think it's actually coupe-ish enough? Because compared to a BMW X4 or even the Audi Q3 Sportback, I actually was a little bit disappointed by how much it looks like the wagon. It kind of feels like Audi's sort of done it halfway through the car's life and it's almost there, but not quite. I don't know whether that is in keeping with the like really strong style statement that people want to make with these cars.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I was more happily surprised that I didn't hate the rear of it when I saw it in person. When I saw it in the photos, I have this issue where a lot of cars abruptly end like straight up and down in the tailgate. And I found this one, it looked a bit stumpy in the press images. And then I got it in person and it was much more resolved. Whether I think it looks coupe enough or not, I'm probably the wrong person to ask, because I hate coupe SUVs normally from a design perspective. I think that Audi's Sportback SUVs have typically been my preference, balancing the SUV and coupe styling. So, but I also think the X4 looks all right, and I think the GLC coupe, like that this segment, the medium sized ones, I think are the more resolved ones. I really don't like the larger ones. The X6, the GLE coupe, don't work for me. I think the Q8 is by far the much better looking vehicle from a rear Stirling perspective. Mm. I also really don't like the Porsche Cayenne coupe. It just looks all sorts of weird. So, like, I'm probably not the right person to ask for that. Do I think it looks good? Yes. And the car I had, even though the press images in my written review will be of a grey vehicle on wheels that I prefer, the car that I had was this beautiful Navara blue with a grey interior, and it was just so classy. And it had the turbine wheels in like a matte silver finish, and it was just a wonderful thing to look at with the grey interior. That's the other thing. They've sort of brought back colours now. The colour palette is no longer the German rainbow. You can get a nice blue. You can get a green. You can get, you know, your greys, blacks, reds, all sorts of stuff. And then obviously if you're feeling particularly creative, you can go through the Quattro GmbH customization program, which basically allows you to paint it whatever you want, provided you can pay for it. So I think for me personally, I really enjoy this car. I love the look of it. I think they'll be really popular. I would like to get a spin in the one that Scott just drove, just to see, you know, if it's worth saving. That's, you know, circa 15 to 20 grand, and, you know, shaving and adding a second to your 0 to 100 time, but, you know, maybe having a petrol engine with real noise might be a little bit more believable, and, you know, it's not pretending to be something it's not. But I think, yeah, they've done a really good job, and they've loaded it with kit. So I imagine the kind of people that buy these cars, if they haven't considered an Audi before because an alternative just didn't exist, I think that, you know, that it's a really compelling value buy alone just on paper. But after driving it, you know, if you love how big Audi's drive, this does it, and it's compact enough to fit in your underground car park while also being big enough to fit your friends and your dog and your luggage and all that sort of stuff. So I was really impressed by it.
Wow, that sounds like an excellent wrap. Those two reviews will be live at carexpert.com.au very soon. Thank you, James Wong, for popping by.
Thank you for having me.
That's the end for this week's podcast. It's so good to see, Scully, that we've got some events and launches back now.
We do, and as it turns out, they are all happening next week. We've got a Kia Sportage event up in Sydney. We've got a passenger ride in the Ineos Grenadier, which is really exciting. I'm not sure who's actually going to that. I believe Simon Christie might be attending for Car Expert, but cannot wait to see how that car stacks up in person. And then Paul is going to be in Sandown for a Walkinshaw Performance Day, and then at Phillip Island driving the Mercedes-AMG Black Series.
Tough
week
day
for our illustrious founder, Paul.
Poor Paul.
And Will, what cars we got coming up?
Well, I've finished my run of like 200 grand cars up here. So I'm swapping for a Ford Ranger into a Ford Everest. In Sydney, we've got the updated Jaguar XF. That's a vehicle that might be featuring on that feature article of mine this weekend. And then Melbourne, there is the new Kia Sportage GT line. Nice. A Honda CR-V. We've had a few CR-Vs through the Brisbane and Melbourne garages. A Lexus UX 250H in a top spec sports luxury trim. A Honda Odyssey. BMW M135i xDrive. Volvo XC40 Recharge Pure Electric. Very keen to hear thoughts on that. And also the updated Subaru Forester. So quite a bit down there. Also, I believe Melbourne is... Hey, Scotty, driving a Polestar 2?
Potentially. That's we're working out the timing on it. I don't know when we have the car, and I think that may move in our calendar. So fingers are crossed, because I'd love to drive the Polestar 2 and the XC40 back-to-back to see how they've separated those cars. Mm. Failing the Polestar 2, we also have an Ioniq 5 booked in for next weekend to compare with the XC40 Recharge Pure Electric, which is a story I'll be doing. So it's a very, very busy week down in Melbourne, and there's a real electric flavour to it.
That's awesome. Can't wait to see all that at Car Expert soon. William Stopford and Scott Colley, hey, thank you.
No, Mandy, thank you.
No, thank you.